If you yearn for the days when pro football players all had off-season jobs and laughed about getting their bells rung instead of concerning themselves with potential brain damage, The Last Headbangers is the book for you. Kevin Cook wrote it, and he joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You begin the book with a story about former Oakland Raiders linebacker Phil Villapiano that makes an important point about NFL players of the 70s. Tell us about Mr. Villapiano's frustration with his helmet and what he did to improve its fit.
Well, Phil Villapiano wasn't happy with the fit before several games, including the Immaculate Reception game. He goes to put the helmet on in the locker room and shakes his head, and the helmet moves around. So he takes it off, goes over to a cement brick wall, and knocks his head on the wall a couple of times. His head then swells a little, helmet fits, and he's ready to go.
And the awful thing about this is many of his teammates probably thought this was entirely rational.
Well, and for Phil, it seems to have been. As he says, he just had a thick skull. A lot of other fellows do seem to be subject to concussion, and some, like Phil Villapiano, definitely are not.
The Raiders of those days were known as outlaws, of course, and perhaps justifiably so, given the way they prepared themselves for games. Give us a sense of the various chemical aids that they used.
Well, there was, not only was there no steroids testing in those days, but I heard several stories about horse testosterone that would be imported from the local racetrack, and the players would take enough for a horse trainer to give a full-fledged, I think that's a 1,500-pound animal, take just as much as a regular horse would have. That gives you gets your nostrils flaring and lets you gets you all set to go out on the field. There was also a really primitive level of human growth hormone that came from sources that would have scared Dr. Frankenstein.
The horse testosterone was easily obtainable because apparently one of the Raiders' trainers also worked at the racetrack, so simple.
Yes, and that's right. And you could tell what you were taking because it had a picture of a horse on the label.
You write of John Matusak, who played for those Raiders, that he, quote, may have led the league in substance abuse. How did he earn that distinction among so many people who were abusing so many substances?
I think it was a tough competition for that. And, of course, it's an unofficial title, but there was a Raiders team physician who described the use of amphetamines, as there were some players who got so high that they were called crop dusters. Matusak was referred to as John Glenn.
Look, Kevin, we're laughing about this stuff, but do you worry at all that The Last Headbangers is going to be seen as glorifying the excess and the abuse that you chronicle?
I think you can glorify the wildness, the vivid, the all-out play, the most all-out play in football history. It's really the decade in which pro football became modern. And I think you have to lament and worry about, I mean, Daryl Stingley is another character, a pivotal character in this time, who was paralyzed for life after a hit from the Raiders. So I think that one can celebrate the competition, but you can never really forget the toll that it took on the players who took part.
In 1973, the average annual NFL salary was $29,000. How were the owners doing financially while the players were working for wages like that?
The owners weren't quite as multi-gazillionaires as they are today, but they were doing very well. I think the players were exploited both physically and financially. You had a couple of Steelers stars who would carpool to ball games in order to save money on gas, Ray Mansfield and Andy Russell. You had Terry Bradshaw selling used cars in the off season, and Franco Harris literally hitchhiking to practice in his rookie year. It's a fascinating thing about the 70s that by the end of this decade, Monday Night Football will have really helped transform the game into something more like what we see today, and money is growing really rapidly. We're talking in The Last Headbangers about the last generation of players who really weren't set for life because they played in the league.
Yeah, in fact, you write at one point that the proceeds from one shaving cream commercial for the Super Bowl would have paid the entire Miami Dolphins backfield.
And that was a great Dolphins team, too. So you do have a situation today in which the players get a great deal of more of a cut of the pie. And I think one thing that both players today and owners today and even fans ought to be cognizant of is that while there's more money going to medical care and pensions for former players, it needs to be even more than it currently is.
The Super Bowl was a big deal already in the 70s, but it's a considerably bigger deal today. Former NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle was a force in making the Super Bowl a major television attraction. How did he go about doing that?
In the first Super Bowl, of which I have dim memories, watching on a little black and white TV screen, part of the halftime entertainment was the release of a flock of pigeons. But I think they did have a great sense that this championship game might have a chance to become the biggest sports event in America. It certainly has, and I think that's another story that I found fascinating during the 70s. At the beginning of the 70s, NFL football wasn't even the top sport. It was just starting to surpass Major League Baseball. And today, the idea that any sport would give the NFL a run for its money is hard to imagine.
Tell us a little bit about how Commissioner Rozelle's views on the halftime entertainment at the Super Bowl evolved. Because at one point you mentioned that after one particular Super Bowl, there were three words he never wanted to hear again.
It was up with people were the words he didn't want to hear. A Pepsodent kind of smiley. They had a famous song, up with people. You meet them wherever you go. They're the best kind of folks we know. They made the Righteous Brothers sound like Jimi Hendrix. And even Rozelle, whose idea of really edgy music was Sinatra on the elevator, thought that it was time to get a little bit more rock and roll, and that sure happened to the NFL. You know, the NFL was not so corporate in those days. It was thought to be the counterculture sport, the sport with big mustaches and long hair and colorful clothing like Frenchie Fuqua's disco platform shoes that had live goldfish swimming around inside.
The second subtitle of your book calls those rowdy, reckless 70s, quote, the era that created modern sports. How so?
I think it was a time in which sports went from being peripheral to the rest of life to really central to American life, a time in which sports became the multi-billion-dollar business that it is today. In the beginning of the 70s, we're still thinking that a football game is something that you get in your car and go to, which some people certainly still do, but the vast majority take in their sports as television programming. The NFL was the greatest first television reality programming, and I think that is really what led to the way that we get 24-hour sports coverage today. In the 70s, players would actually go out drinking with fans, which is fairly hard to believe today, Then came this period, this television-driven, money-driven period in which sports ballooned to the dominant position they're in today.
Kevin Cook is the author of The Last Headbangers, published by Norton. Among his other books is Titanic Thompson. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jose Masso, Peter Laidotes, and Kelvin Brooks. We bid a very fond adieu this week to our intern, Philip Kisubika, who apparently sees fit to abandon the program for the shaky prospect of higher education. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our Cuban softball and Braille photo galleries, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word comes from the Cuban drummers who insisted on being heard at the historic softball game between the U.S. and Cuban softball players last weekend. That's not bad. Keep it up, fellas. Eventually, you'll move on up to take me out to the ball game. I feel a little ill. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.